people everywhere trying to make higher ground. Many met their maker in a watery grave. Many met their maker in a watery grave. If your neighbor had a boy.
This is Climate Summer, and I'm your host, Julie Hantman, coming to you live from the Tacoma Radio Studio in Tacoma Park, Maryland, right outside Washington, D.C. Climate Summer is a two-part series on climate change about what we're experiencing right here in the D.C. area related to heat and flooding. And I'm here today with episode two with three special guests to discuss the topic of flooding, present and future, right here in Washington, D.C. and near in Maryland, how flooding is related to climate change and what we can do about it. Tough discussion, yes, but community radio is a great place to have it. California wildfire coverage aside, across our nation, the mainstream media does a pretty poor job of covering climate change. And I don't have evidence right now, but I am guessing that flooding gets some of the least attention because, unlike heat, which we discussed in July on this series, flooding is kind of invisible to people unless it shows up on your street. The truth is we are all living climate change. So news snippets are important, but they don't really cut it. We need conversation to really digest the info so we can help each other shift into a new mindset and get into action to protect our world. So without further ado, let me introduce my wonderful guests. Sandra Knight is with the University of Maryland Center for Disaster Resilience, where she is a research engineer. Before that, she's held top government positions at FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Astrid Caldas is with the Union of Concerned Scientists, where she is a senior climate scientist. Originally an ecologist, Astrid does research on climate change adaptation and the implications for ecosystems, the economy, and society, and she also works on climate communication. Marcos Yarla is currently with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Baltimore District. Marco is the project manager and public information specialist, and he manages studies under the Floodplain Management Services Program in both the Baltimore and Washington, D.C. region. Both Sandra and Marco work with something called the Silver Jackets team, which you'll hear more about later. So let's get into this. Let's begin with Sandra Knight of the University of Maryland. Sandra, Washington, D.C. isn't Miami. We're not on the coast. Sure, it rains, but it rains everywhere. What are the unique factors that make D.C. vulnerable to flooding? Can you give us kind of a verbal tour, a reminder of D.C.'s geography and the water around us? And what kinds of flooding are we worried about the most?
Sure, Julie, thanks. Well, we are on a coast. We're up the Chesapeake Bay, and we are subject to tidal influences and coastal storms. And that's not the only way we can get hit. We can get hit by riverine flooding. We are geographically located at the confluence of the Anacostia and the Potomac Rivers. And then we have interior flooding, or as us geeky people might call it, pluvial flooding, whereas riverine is called fluvial. Interior flooding from rainfall is called pluvial.
All right. It's funny you said that and corrected me. Thank you. When I moved here 15 years ago, I thought I was moving to an inland city. It just didn't occur to me, right, that we're so near the ocean and then that the bay has a big effect on our city.
I think people forget, but you can see seagulls, and we certainly have this thing called the tidal basin down by the Jefferson Memorial.
Right. So what's the function of the tidal basin, by the way?
Well, it retains water to help the flooding, but if you've ever been down there, at least in recent years, you'll notice that that area floods frequently now due to nuisance flooding.
Right, and we'll get more to that later. All right, great. Let me turn to Astrid Caldas of the Union of Concerned Scientists, along with Sandra Knight. Okay, so how is all this water and rain related to climate change? Astrid, go for it.
I'm going for it. Thanks, Julie. Well, the main thing that we see is that with global warming, the atmosphere is warmer, and warmer air holds more water. So when there is more water vapor held in the atmosphere, when it rains, there is the potential for a lot more water to come down. That is the one thing that Sandra mentioned about the pluvial flooding. That's the flooding that is due to rain. And we know also that extreme precipitation events, geeky speak, extreme precipitation events are increasing all over the country. And that's like the top 1%. Most intense rain events are increasing in frequency and the amount of water that they are dumping. So in addition to that, in coastal areas like in D.C. and Maryland, we also have sea level rise. Because when the air is warmer, a lot of that warmth is actually absorbed by the oceans. About 93% of it has been absorbed by the oceans. So when it gets warmer, it expands. When it expands, it has nowhere to go but up. And with that, sea level rises and more tidal flooding occurs. Flooding just due to tides, high tides.
So high tides get higher because they're boosted up by the higher sea level.
Yep. The tides are the same. They don't change. The tides, astronomical tides, as we call them, they don't change. But they are riding on higher seas, so they are going farther and farther inland.
And are we seeing that already going up the Potomac?
Absolutely. Up the Potomac and on the eastern shore of Maryland, it's really a huge problem.
I get those D.C. alerts on my texts, on my cell phone, and it always talks about Haynes Point. We'll get to some of that.
Yes.
Some of those. Okay. My main thought right now is maybe feel free to go into a little more detail in the science, because I want to know how much of the future flooding is carved in stone and how much flooding are we talking about potentially seeing in the D.C. and Maryland area versus how much do we stand a chance of pushing the waters back, as it were?
Well, I'd just like to say, too, that we know climate change is exacerbating the problem. But we have a problem anyway, particularly interior flooding. And that's because of a very old and aging infrastructure, our storm sewer systems, our streets, the urbanization of our watersheds. That's impacted how much rainfall, the places where rainfall can go. So then add extreme events on top of it, and now we're really adding to the problem. So it's a problem. Even if there weren't climate change, we would be dealing with flood issues that are of our own making due to urbanization and development.
Got it. So basically we have rain coming down in our area and D.C. with the combined sewer stormwater systems often flooding a lot. And then we've got rain in Maryland coming down the rivers. I know Sligo Creek here goes into the Anacostia, and the Rock Creek goes into the Potomac. So we've got local creeks feeding into that. And then all that you talked about as well from sea level rise.
And the sea level rise, yes, that's a big factor, because if the rain hits when it's high tide, then all that flow and stormwater systems get affected, and the water doesn't flow as well. And speaking about the future, we say that we have some sea level rise already baked in, because even if we stopped emissions right now, there is some warmth that's already in there, and that's going to account for sea level rise at least till mid-century.
Emissions from greenhouse gases,
carbon emissions mainly, yes.
Okay. All right, let's take a short break. And next up, where are specifically some of the places that we do see flooding in Maryland and D.C.?
Rising, a footy-foot wall of water, crushing down, they held a breath, prayed to God in the hour of death, to save them from the ocean. Rising, rising, a dream of the
This is Climate Summer on Tacoma Radio 94.3 and streaming live at tacomaradio.org. I'm Julie Hantman, speaking with Sandra Knight of the University of Maryland, Marco Charla of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and Astrid Caldas of the Union of Concerned Scientists about climate change and flooding in D.C. and near in Maryland. Let's bring in Marco Charla of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to talk about where it actually floods. Let's talk about places we know of, we can see. The biggest flood that folks recall in this area was the recent flooding of Ellicott City, Maryland. We saw the TV coverage. We know it's a basin or something like that. But Marco, can you sort of tell us the story of Ellicott City, why it's at risk, and maybe a little bit about what's being done there?
Sure, and thanks for having us on this radio show, Julie. Basically, we did a non-structural floodproofing study in Ellicott City in 2016 after the first set of flooding. And what happened was essentially there was a very intense rainfall that put down about 6 inches of rain in 2 hours. And that what that causes is a ton of rain to come into one area in a very short period of time. And what happens with the topography of Ellicott City is it essentially funnels down to the Patapsco River, and you have the convergence of multiple streams that doesn't help things. And so also you have a very tight corridor where buildings are essentially aggregated towards the bottom of this hill. And with all these factors combined, you have a lot of water coming very fast with short warning time, and it's causing rapid velocities in the flood water, which tears apart the streets and the buildings, and it's also causing huge flood depths. So that same thing happened 2 years later in 2018, this past summer, with the tragic floods, and it was actually, I believe, 10 inches of rain in 5 hours. So this just combination of events is almost the, you know, for lack of a better term, a perfect storm of events that ended up causing this catastrophic flooding.
Remind us again what it is you said at the top there that the Army Corps had done, and what's the future?
Sure. So after the 2016 floods, the Army Corps had performed a non-structural floodproofing assessment. Essentially, we were looking at how buildings could be retrofitted throughout the city to make them more resilient to future flooding. However, a lot of the things we were looking at unfortunately would probably not have prevented damages from these sorts of floods. It probably would prevent damages from smaller type flooding, short, you know, smaller depths of flooding and slower velocities. But the fact is that they were also looking at large watershed-wide measures with other contractors, which were looking at retention ponds. They were looking at conveyance, diverging conveyance through tunneling into the Patapsco. Lots of drastic measures that are very expensive and take a long time to implement. And so they were also looking at us to add to their toolkit. Okay, what if we considered building retrofits, elevations of the sort of what they call wet flood proofing, when you allow water into the building to prevent structural damage, or dry flood proofing, which actually prevents water from entering the building. These were the type of measures we were looking throughout the city to see if we could help the residents have just another option for creating more resiliency.
And that's where it stands now, is looking at options. Is that right? Or
well, since the 2018 flooding, you know, they had to reevaluate. A lot of the members came back into the community. They built back in, you know, record time, I would say, and they were looking good. And unfortunately, this event came again in 2018. So right now, you know, they're working on a plan forward.
Sandra, do you want to comment?
Oh, yes. I mean, these are really hard decisions for towns and cities like this. This city was built there historically because it was on the water. And so we have a lot of historic buildings, but with time, flood risk is just going up. And I think Astrid could probably speak to this, but we're looking at extreme rainfall events that are no longer, these were called 1,000-year events. And I think that's a misnomer on what the real flooding probabilities are. The town is historically flooded regardless of precipitation, and now we have these almost atmospheric rivers and strange coastal events that are coming in, and we can't keep basing what we're doing on historical rainfall. We need to consider climate change.
Correct. I would add that the National Weather Service keeps records of what they call exceeding events. It has a geeky name, but I'll go with exceeding. It's rainfall events that are expected to occur very rarely, like 0.1%, 1,000-year events, as they call it. And there have been just about, I want to say around 20, maybe give or take a few. Most of them have been. There was one before 1920. All of the others have been since 2010 or 2008. So the number of these events is increasing, and they are records exceeding amount of rain for a 3-hour event like Ellicott City, for a 2-day event like Hurricane Harvey, for a 5-day event like, you know, the second flood of Ellicott City. So you have all these records, and they're coming fast and furious. And we really have to plan for the future. We have to really see where we're going in order to plan, because past historic patterns mm-hmm. do not hold anymore.
Mm-hmm. And Ellicott City is a drastic example, but we're also speaking of these risks in DC proper, and Yeah.
Just this summer, we saw how many floods did we see during this event that went all over the East Coast, right? Everything was flooding.
Right.
So all over the East Coast, D.C., Maryland, there was flood every day on the news.
There's a flood alert right now, I think.
Yes, we are under flood.
Tomorrow or
something. We are.
Yes. So that's not a laughing matter. But let's go back to Marco Cerulla of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Who's on this? Let's talk about the Army Corps and about some of the cross-cutting groups and initiatives that are working on this throughout the D.C. area.
Sure. Well, the Army Corps of Engineers is a federal agency, and it's under the Department of Defense. There's over 37,000 civilian and military personnel, and it makes it one of the largest, one of the world's largest engineering, design, and construction management agencies. So that's just a little bit of background of what we do, all things engineering, large and small.
And I always thought that it was really like dams out west. And here you are. I found you and I'm like, oh, there's right. Army Corps in D.C. What are they up to? Yeah,
absolutely. Well, like I said, we were involved in large and small, historically large flood control projects like levees and dams. Now we're shifting our mission a little bit towards flood risk reduction. And so we're looking at ways to adapt to flooding. We still deal with the levees. We still manage the dams. In fact, in our area of responsibility for just the Baltimore District, we manage over 100 levees. And that's, you know, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Maryland, parts of New York. So, just goes to show you the breadth of kind of the scope of work that the Army Corps is working under. It is a federal agency, and we work closely with local agencies as well to manage smaller projects and work with local communities as well.
Okay, so is it up to the Army Corps to solve these problems in D.C.? Is it up to the D.C. government? Who is it up to?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think it's all about collaboration and coordination. And the Army Corps of Engineers right now, we work through this the Silver Jackets program, which is a national program, and every state has a team, an interagency team, made up of local, state, sometimes tribal, academia representatives, and we collaborate. And we leverage our resources and we try to find solutions to the flood risk issues that we see in each one of these states. And they're all unique, but the district, we've talked about some of the flood risk concerns that are in the district. We work with all the local agencies, or many of them, and a lot of the federal agencies, stakeholders that are in the district to try to see what we can do about this flood issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to go now to some of the projects and studies throughout the city? Or
we can do that.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. 2 years ago, we put together a flood inundation mapping tool, which is an amazing digital service worked with the National Weather Service, where you can go online, and when you hear the forecast from National Weather Service, you can actually go on the online tool. It's very user-friendly, and you can look at your house to see what the flooding in your immediate area is going to look like. And that's all part of the coordination efforts that we have in these DC, in the Silver Jackets programs, where we're working with different stakeholders like the National Weather Service and agencies and DC, and we come up with these very cool projects, and I can list many more.
I think the interesting thing about Silver Jackets is each state is their own chapter, and DC's not, we'd like to be a state, but at this point we're not, but we have our own chapter. And so our Silver Jackets includes the federal agencies like USGS and NOAA and Corps, and it also includes National Park Service and the Department of Energy and the Environment, WMATA, and DC Water, to mention a few, and some of our military partners. And so Bloomingdale, you mentioned Bloomingdale. The Army Corps projects wouldn't impact Bloomingdale. This is a case of interior flooding. This is a case of old and aged combined sewer systems. And Bloomingdale, that neighborhood flooded three times in 10 days in 2012. And a lot of it was because, and this is some nasty stuff, right? When the sewer's backing up, it's backing up in your house, and this is really, really bad. But I will say, between Silver Jackets, us all being aware and working together, DC Water's had a really aggressive program on increasing their capacity at Blue Plains, the treatment facility. They've had, and increasing the holding and the pipes and the retention of some of the water. It's not completed, But it's complementary also with what the Department of Energy and the Environment's doing in terms of impervious surfaces, green roofs, some of their special programs that are trying to absorb some of the water. So there's a lot of things that are going on, and I think the Silver Jackets is allowing us to collaborate and coordinate mm-hmm. on how we can best share our expertise and information.
You mentioned Blue Plains. The fix there, is that going to help solve some of this combined sewer, yeah. wastewater?
Yes, yeah, it will. It's stormwater. A bigger facility. It's a very modern state-of-the-art facility, as well as big pipes. And I don't know the complete details. It's not finished yet, but they're in process. So it will alleviate some of the storm sewer problems as well mm-hmm. as replacing. So it's a work in process to replace old infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And then also DC Water was involved in Bloomingdale putting a huge pipe, I think I read, underground to
yes,
contain.
Yes, that's part of the system, and part of the retention system is a underground storage of water and bigger pipes so that they can hold the water until they can treat it.
So Bloomingdale residents should be seeing some relief in their homes, I guess. We're not sure about that.
Hopefully
we're crossing
so.
Fingers over yeah. here. Okay. Yeah. How about maybe we'll look at Watts Branch? That's come up. That's a tributary of the Anacostia, I think. Is there, what's the situation there? Is anyone familiar
yeah.
with that?
Yep. That's another project that we're currently working through the Silver Jackets partnerships, and our lead partner on that one is Department of Energy and Environment. And what we're looking at is the flood risk for a neighborhood in Northeast DC that runs from the Anacostia out to the eastern boundary. We're looking at the flood risk that's associated with this neighborhood, and this neighborhood has its challenges. It's dealing with gentrification issues. It's a vulnerable neighborhood. It was identified as one of the top four priorities in the DC climate change plan, and so we looked at the flood risk and the flood vulnerability of Watts Branch, and through modeling efforts we're looking at the existing and future flood risk issues that are associated with Watts Branch, and we're starting to collaborate together to identify some solutions to potentially ameliorate these issues in the future here.
Okay, let's have one more significant conversation before leading to our next musical break, if people can hang in there. The biggest surprise for me in researching this topic of flooding was learning that downtown DC can take some serious water and may be in for more if climate change proceeds largely unchecked. Marco Cerullo, why is there a flooding risk in downtown DC specifically, and where are we talking about? I know we're talking about literally some of the sidewalks people walk every day.
Absolutely, and you're talking about one of the top tourist attraction areas probably in the country, in Federal Triangle and the National Mall. Federal Triangle is the area just north, actually, of the National Mall that has a lot of the DC agency headquarters and office buildings. You have some Smithsonian's in that area. You have the EPA building. In that area, in 2006, there was flash flooding that came about because of intense rainfall, similar to what we were discussing about Ellicott City. And a lot of rain, about 6 inches, came in, I believe, 5 hours, something like that. And the storm sewer system, which was initially designed to take in a 15-year design storm, was all of a sudden exposed to this massive, intense amount of rain. So when that all came down, the sewer system backed up, and the flooding just essentially started piling up on the streets. And you have to understand, historically, the Federal Triangle area was the old Tiber Creek. And, you know, like we usually do, us humans, we build on top of swamps and creeks. And so this is one of the lowest points in the city. And you can imagine that this drainage area, I believe it's around 5 square miles, comes down into this low area. And when you put enough water in a short period of time, it's going to back up the sewer system, even if there's pumps that are taking stuff down to Blue Plains. And so right now it's a susceptible area. There is a levee that runs along the northern side of the reflecting pool to protect or reduce risk from the Potomac and from coastal backup from the Chesapeake. But interior drainage or heavy rainfall is not something that the levee is going to reduce risk for.
Marco talked about floodproofing, and so after the 2006 flood, some of our major buildings, like the archives and others, did some things, put in some walls. The National African American History and Cultural Museum, it sits in the lowest spot in the mall, and they've built in some floodproofing features. But I think it's still for us to be diligent and concerned, because with climate change and sea level rise, it also impacts the groundwater. And these buildings are impacted by groundwater in that area as well. So it's not just this more intense rainfall, it's urbanization of the watershed, and it's this rise of sea level that can push the groundwater into this area too.
You've mentioned some of the assets that are vulnerable downtown. I mean, it strikes me, you know, is government operations potentially at risk if there's a big storm? Not to mention archives and all the documents and
the IRS flood.
Well, I don't miss the IRS. If the IRS floods, that's okay with me. But the archive, no, I'm just kidding.
Well, and that's why we have an current interagency project. This is what I was saying. There's too many to list all at once. Yeah. Our current interagency project through Silver Jackets is what we're calling the Federal Triangle Workshops. And we had one earlier in June when we brought together 75 plus stakeholders in the area from the different agencies, from the Smithsonian, from the GSA buildings, building installation managers, people like Sandra, experts in the field. They all came and we started brainstorming. What are the opportunities and challenges in this area? Not necessarily looking for the single solution, the silver bullet. We're looking to see what are the priorities of the stakeholders in the area and how can we brainstorm for solutions. And we have our second workshop actually coming up here in early September, where we're going to start talking about more palpable options for reducing the flood risk.
Is fixing or let's say enhancing that Potomac Park levee, which is on the National Mall, a big part of the solution? And where does that stand?
Well, the Federal Triangle Workshops specifically focus on that interior drainage or rainfall issue. The DC levee risk communication, the DC levee is another project that we're looking at as well. We're performing risk communication to the public, and it's coming up soon. But essentially, we do levee risk screenings, and we identify issues associated with the different levees in our area of responsibility in Baltimore District. But this Federal Triangle specifically is more about the rain that comes down, the intensity. And so we're looking for the interior drainage issues and some of the potential solutions moving forward.
Got it. But there may be a need to also enhance the levee based on the risks it was built for. Is that right?
There is ongoing efforts right now to raise the levee to its authorized height. Currently, it protects, it reduces risk. We got to keep saying that. It reduces risk because it will never fully be protected now with all the new data we get in. It reduces risk for a 1,000-year storm, which means every year you have a 0.1% chance, of a rainstorm of the magnitude to overtop the levee actually happening. But again, we are looking to raise the levee to authorized height, and there's contingency levee ideas coming in that are being studied by the national parks. We're working with them as well.
This is on their property.
It's on their property, mm-hmm. Yes.
And we are seeing these 0.1% probability storms happening more often than we would expect. And the 0.2 probability ones also, so they pile on top of each other. So that's why it's essential to plan for these more rare than what was before the 15-year, which is a lot higher probability than the 1,000-year. So
I would add, too, you can get both of these things or all these things at once, and it's very likely. Look at what happened in Houston or any place. You have a big, slow-moving hurricane tropical storm carrying lots of moisture. It pushes water up the Chesapeake Bay, up the Potomac, and so you're flooded from the where the levee would protect, while you're also getting hammered with rain. So imagine that these compound events, we have to assume they will happen. So we could get flooding from both directions. You could be protected by a certain size coastal storm, but while you're also being inundated with rainfall in the Federal Triangle area.
So coastal storm coming up the Potomac, water coming down the Potomac potentially from storms in Maryland, and then rain in D.C. causing interior flooding here. That's a lot of water.
Water everywhere.
Yeah. So later we'll talk about whether there's enough attention to and getting solutions in place fast enough and that sort of thing. But let's take another break. And next up, we turn to Annapolis and look at the flooding situation in the capital of Maryland.
Can't even get out my door.
Let's turn now to Astrid Caldas again of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Astrid has been studying some areas in depth, and that includes Annapolis, Maryland, and the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Let's start with Annapolis. We've all heard of Miami, New Orleans being on the front lines for coastal flooding, but it turns out Annapolis also gets the brunt of things, so to speak, as seas rise and rains increase. And that is the capital of the state of Maryland and pretty darn close to D.C. So Astrid, will you please tell us first, what's the situation with flooding in Annapolis and what's the city or state doing about it?
All right. Annapolis, sea level at Annapolis has risen by more than a foot over the last century, more than twice the global average. And just since 1990, it has risen by 3 inches or more by now. So the number of minor floods occurring in Annapolis are more than double in the past century. And it sees flood conditions for more than 85 hours per year. That's a lot of flooding. And the City Dock area sees that type of flooding around 50 times per year at least. That's a lot of nuisance, as they call it, the sunny day flooding. That doesn't need to have rain. This is just the tide coming in. Annapolis is an area that's very, very vulnerable to high tides. And we did some analysis using an intermediate sea level rise scenario projection from the National Climate Assessment. Those were projections developed by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for the U.S. National Climate Assessment. And the intermediate scenario assumes that global carbon emissions will rise through the middle of the century and then begin to decline, and that the ice sheets will melt at rates in line with historical observations. This is a very optimistic scenario. We are not seeing that happening, but we sure hope for it. But under that scenario, our projections estimate that just 15 years from now, Annapolis will see another half foot of sea level rise and a tripling of flood events to around 180 per year. And that is just going to keep going up. And by 2045, it would be 360 per year. And not only that, that's just the number of events, but we also did an analysis for the on the areas that are most vulnerable to what we call chronic inundation. Chronic inundation is inundation by high tide only that occurs at least 26 times per year or every other week on average. And we evaluated the number of properties in Annapolis that will be subjected to that type of chronic inundation. And we have found that by 2045, about 200 homes, not including commercial properties, 200 homes will be at risk of this type of chronic inundation. So Annapolis is really like Miami Beach in Maryland. They don't see a lot of their area inundated. The area that inundates, it's not even 10% of their usable land, but they're already spending a lot of money and they have a lot of initiatives, and I can tell you a little more about those.
Yeah, sure.
It's not only the businesses and the homes, but the historic buildings that are in Annapolis that are part of our history, and the United States Naval Academy, which is a huge part of our history also. Annapolis has several initiatives, the City Dock Master Plan. They have the Weather It Together Plan that has been around for about 5 years now, where they kind of get everybody together to plan for the flood. They have a comprehensive plan, a hazard mitigation plan. They have a community plan for people to try to reduce their emissions at the home level. And also, of course, the U.S. Naval Academy mm-hmm. is partnering with FEMA and a lot of other organizations and agencies to reduce flooding at their headquarters.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and do folks in Annapolis really get it? I mean, the common person.
Oh, yeah.
In Annapolis.
Annapolis lives around the floods. It's like, it's going to flood today. They plan, they stop, they close a store, they walk around, they know where they can and cannot go. They know how to navigate the floods by now.
And actually, the city of Annapolis, partnered with the Army Corps of Engineers to do a floodproofing study there as well. And again, it had some parallels to Ellicott City with the historic structures. And so that one of the challenges with keeping a historic location historic is how do you alter a building or make it, improve it for resiliency for flooding while keeping that historic look. And you don't want to displace any of the housing stock. You don't want to have to remove houses out of their area because, it's all part of that community cohesion and that historic look. You don't want to start putting holes in it. And so people are looking at all different types of solutions for reducing their flood risk to the different buildings. They also asked us, the city of Annapolis also partnered with us so that we would model their stormwater. And so they're looking at stormwater solutions as well, upgrading their infrastructure.
Yes.
They're looking at different solutions. They're really trying to live with the water, but it's tough when, like you said, this data comes in saying that you're becoming more and more susceptible to flooding.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Astrid, let's travel now to the Eastern Shore. Can you tell us a little about what this region is geographically for those who don't know it and what flooding challenges are facing this area?
Everybody is pretty much at risk at the Eastern Shore of Maryland. When we did that analysis of communities that would be subjected to that chronic inundation that I mentioned of 26 times per year by high tides alone, Maryland is only second only to Louisiana in the number of communities that will be chronically inundated. It has currently 12 communities already seeing that type of inundation, and the number is going to increase by 17 more in just 30 years, and then it's going to keep going up. It's a very low-lying area. Not only it's low-lying and the sea level is rising, but also the land is sinking, what we call subsidence. So you add the land going down, the water going up, more and more flooding, and the extent of the flood is really increasing. So those communities also are very used to living with the water. They have saltwater cars. When the high tide flood comes, they use their saltwater car. They don't want to use their good car. They have parking areas that are higher up so that they put their car in that higher area when the tide comes. They have a kind of a network of parents when the high tide comes to figure out how far the buses can go to pick up the students. And they all take their students to the same point where that's the farthest that the bus can go. So these communities are living for years with these challenges. And there is also, of course, the issue of social vulnerability and socioeconomic vulnerability, which is huge on the Eastern Shore. They have historic fishermen communities. They have historic Black communities there. They have their social vulnerability is high due to income, housing pricing, ethnicity, age. There are people at the Eastern Shore, the young people are leaving, and it's the older people who are remaining there, and they cannot work the same way that they did before, and the fisherman life is also under big stress because of climate change, changing the bay, the fisheries, everything that they spent their whole life for generations on. So the Eastern Shore of Maryland is very vulnerable to both the sea level rise and socioeconomically, but they are doing an excellent job of being aware and trying to fight as much as they can to keep their properties and their way of life and their culture.
And are some towns having a harder time than others based on some of the factors you were talking about?
They do. For instance, Oxford is a town that is more high-end. There are lots of people who come and have second homes there and people who retire there. They have a big plan to reduced flooding on their main. There's only one road in and out. They call it the causeway, I believe. So they have plans for ponds to keep the water when the tide comes in. They have plans for living shorelines, which are barriers to the water coming into the city that are not completely hard barriers. They allow for natural life and fisheries and plants. That's why they are called living shorelines. And there are lots of regulations that are very important for the Eastern Shore. They have regulations of wetlands, which are migrating. So the wetlands go up, they become, your property may become part of the state regulated area because it's a wetland now. So they have to deal with all these challenges. And depending on where you are, places like Deal Island, where it has is not a high-end community like Oxford. I'm not saying all of Oxford is, if you're listening, people in Oxford. I know that you're really, really trying hard to do the best, and I know the city administrator, she's doing a wonderful job. And but places like Deal Island, and you go towards the end of Deal Island, Hopper's Island, and all the that part, it's really low lying. They call it, they have a bridge that they say that's going to be called the bridge from nowhere to nowhere because the land on both sides is going down and only the bridge is going to remain. So.
Thank you. That's quite a painting of a picture.
Very
there.
Sobering.
Yeah, yes. Sobering. I want to do something really brief before going to a break. You have a very important major report that came out on flooding and its effect on real estate, Astrid, the Union of Concerned Scientists, nationally. Do you want to talk just a little bit about that? And I know that the issue of flood insurance is part of that, and maybe we can go to Sandra as well about the flood insurance
program.
That'll
be great. Okay. I'm just going to tell you the results. So this is based on the same chronic inundation of at least 26 times per year due to high tides only. And if you get the whole Maryland Congressional District 1, which encompasses all of the Eastern Shore pretty much, we have that in less than 30 years, the lifetime of a mortgage, we'll have about 17,000 homes that are going to be subjected to this type of chronic inundation. And they are worth a collective $4 billion. And about 34,000 people live in those houses. So that's in less than 30 years. So people are buying houses, people have a mortgage. Their property, their life asset may not be worth as much as they would expect within 15 or 20 years. And that is just heartbreaking. And that's why we say communicating the risks to homeowners, communicating the risks to people, and try best not only at the local level, but also the state level and mainly the federal level, because local people cannot do it alone. They have to have federal resources. Get all this information together and try to come up with adaptation measures and policies. And Sandra can speak about the National Flood Insurance Program.
Oh, yes. Well, the National Flood Insurance Program has 22,000 communities around the country. And if you're in the 100-year, as they call it, which I hate to use that. It's a standard for insurance that says if you have a home that has a federally backed mortgage, then you must buy insurance. It's not easily enforced, and it's very hard for back to vulnerable communities and people that can't afford the insurance are most impacted. So there's an issue with having the pricing on the insurance being actuarially sound, because this is taxpayer supported, and also having it affordable. And as sea levels rise and these special flood hazard areas grow and move inward, then we're going to have more houses that are vulnerable and more homes and more people that are
vulnerable. And more people who have to buy flood insurance because they're within the zone that used to be a smaller zone.
Right.
So, and that I've understood that actually is a disincentive for selling. If someone knows they're in a flood zone, they don't want to have to pay flood insurance.
Absolutely. So no one wants to disclose, yet it's so important to disclose. As a buyer, it's the most important purchase you'll ever make as a individual, and you need to know what you're getting into before you make that purchase.
Okay. Let's go to a very short break. And next up, how to address the flood insurance program and also all this water in other ways.
Hives are gone, I lost my bees. Chickens are sleeping in the willow trees. Cows in water up past their knees. 3 feet high and rising.
How high's the water, mama? 4 feet high and rising. How high's the water, papa? She said it's 4 feet high and rising. Hey, come look through the window pane. The bus is coming, gonna take us to the train.
This is Climate Summer on Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM and streaming live at tacomaradio.org. I'm Julie Hantman, talking with guests from the Union of Concerned Scientists, the University of Maryland, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers about climate change and flooding in D.C. and near in Maryland. Sandra, do you just want to touch briefly on the National Flood Insurance Program? It was in the news recently. It was supposed to be revised. I know there's a lot of critiques or issues with the program, but can you just focus in on what kind of revisions were done or need to be done to help in the age of climate change?
Well, yes, I think the extension just kicked the can down the road, basically.
It was extended.
It was extended. The authorization was extended, but no reform. And there's been discussion of reform since the program was put in place in the late 60s, because it's very complicated. As I said, it needs to be actuarially sound. We now have to deal with affordability and the issues of increasing risk. And it needs to incentivize mitigation to mitigate flood hazard, but also to disincentivize development. And it doesn't do that. So it's a complicated program. Everyone on both sides of the fence is interested. Mm-hmm. And so I used to say that the program got a lot of bipartisan love, but they haven't made any real steps to reforms that will be lasting and enduring. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, if you know your risk, you should get, and you have a home, whether you have a federally backed mortgage or not, you need to get insurance. This is your most important investment, and you don't want to lose it to flood. You will be made more whole than you would post-disaster from individual assistance.
Right, right. In general, Sandra or Astrid, do you want to talk about means of adaptation? No one likes to adapt to things they don't even like thinking about, but some of the kinds of adaptation we're seeing in the region, is it enough, or are there wholesale ways of thinking about adaptation that we just haven't even begun to think about yet?
I think I'll just start and then pass the baton to Sandra. We at UCS like to say that there are three main buckets of adaptation that the cities and local jurisdictions can turn to. One of them is to accommodate the water, which is having some areas that can flood that are not going to cause a lot of damage. The other bucket is to protect against the water, and that includes hard structures like walls, seawalls, berms, and things like that, and also living shorelines, oyster reefs, increasing wetlands to reduce that surge and to attenuate, as we call it, the water power coming, and that reduces erosion. And the third bucket, unfortunately, is what we call the retreat, which sometimes there's just so much adaptation you can do, and some areas are not ideal for any of the other two buckets. They either don't have the space to be used for accommodating the water, or the structural, natural or otherwise, barriers do not work well. So these are the main three buckets, and we all try to work with a kind of a mix and match of those.
Mm-hmm. I think we really have to imagine that we will have a new coastline, and we need to change our policies and our programs to invest in the right way. And so we have to think about the future and adjust programs like the Stafford Act and the Flood Insurance Program, and where we build is going to be different in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and along those lines, you know, there's things that the residents can do as well, just regular homeowners. We keep talking about, solving the issues of flood risk as a shared responsibility. You know, people need to become more aware of their flood risk. As Sandra mentioned, we always recommend people getting flood insurance, because the floodplain is everywhere. Whether it's the 1,000-year storm or the 10,000-year storm, just because you're not in the 100-year storm, it does not mean you're out of risk. At flood risk. And so, you know, it's up to the community members to also reach out to the different available resources that the various local agencies are providing. I just want to do a quick plug for the DC NCPC, National Capital Planning Commission, because they put out a report in coordination with Silver Jackets recently that basically has resources of all the different flood risk management studies. But before I wrap this up, I just want to also mention that, you know, homeowners should look to do simple things, elevate their valuables out of the basements, elevate their utilities on the outside of their homes. Look at flood vents for allowing water to come in different areas of their buildings to make their buildings more structurally sound during floods. And then have emergency evacuation plans, during floods, and know where you're going to go to. Are you going to have to go to the top floor? Is that high enough? If you're a business especially, where are your most important items? Are they in the basement? Can you elevate them to the top floor? And so these are the type of considerations that, you know, we consider a shared responsibility that homeowners and residents should also be looking to inform themselves on that.
You mentioned a website before, a new online tool. You know, you can put in your address and get your flood risk. Is that right? Something you can?
Yeah, the flood inundation mapping tool is online. It's on the National Weather Service website. And, you know, just Google it. Mm-hmm. And again, you can just go on there. And once the National Weather Service puts out a forecast, you're able to input that forecast and you're able to look in your neighborhood to see what the flooding is going to look like.
Okay. And Astrid, Sandra, we have no time, unfortunately, for an important conversation about really the big picture. But what can be done? What needs to be done in terms of leadership and policy to cut greenhouse gases, you know, to look more at flooding as an important and elevated issue?
I would just mention what I always say, to end on a high note, a positive note. It's not all gloom and doom. We have baked sea level rise and warming until mid-century, but the choices we make in the next 20, 30 years are going to determine if at the end of the century we're going to have a lot of sea level rise or not a lot of sea level rise. So globally, we should really act to reduce emissions to limit sea level rise.
I want to thank my excellent guests on Tacoma Radio for the opportunity for this today. And don't forget to keep up the climate conversation. Stay tuned for Rock Continuum with Steve Lorberg, next up on 94.3 FM.
Night and day, all the gold and silver being stolen away. Pick your Turner, looking east and west from the dark room of his mind. He made your Kansas City, 12th Street and Vine. Nothing standing there.